taught me how to listen. It's called The Listening Song, also called Simply Speak, music from Sherry Kege. 13 minutes after the hour, it's a Monday, April the 8th, and we're Broken Road Radio. Glad to have you along today. And joining us now from Garden Valley, Texas, is Dr. Don Clark. Don, a biochemist and member of the board of Creation Moments. Don, happy Monday to you.
Well, happy Monday to you.
And Heike Dodge is with us, and David. And the topic today is, now, if I say, at first, the word that first occurred to me was decertification. But that's not it. It's desertification. And like I mentioned a minute ago, probably has nothing to do with creme brulee or brownies, is my guess, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Unless, you know, unless they actually have some soybeans.
We're getting bad audio here. I'm just, hopefully this will improve in just a second here. Because sometimes Skype takes a few seconds to get up to speed here. So we'll kind of do that. There is a link to the topic that will be on our website a little bit later with the audio archive of our conversation this morning. And it's on the Mercola website. And this is a video by Alan Savory, who was an ecologist, apparently. Been around a long time and been studying the problem and readily admits to some grave errors in his earlier training and assumptions. And what it is the losing of land area, a productive, fertile land area, and its slow, maybe irreversible drift into desert, hence desertification, the converting of productive land to desert land. Don, tell us about what the word means, and is it a threat? Is it a good thing, a bad thing?
Well, it's a major.
Well, we just we're
that's for sure, and that's why.
Don, we're not going to be able to do this. Apparently, Skype is simply not going to perform for us this morning. So I'll tell you what, we'll see.
Hello?
I can hear just about every fourth word here, and a lot of silence. So I think what we'll do is.
Oh, okay.
Let me try a couple songs here, and we'll have some time to fiddle with this. Maybe we can get the signal a little bit better. Music from Billy Williams.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Oh yeah, Billy Williams. I'm gonna sit right down, write myself a letter. The song that's probably older than any of us, except maybe David. And hello, David. Are you there? That's just a little shot, just a little thing to get it going this morning.
Just a little shot to get my attention.
It's about 18 minutes now after the hour. We're going to try it again here. I want to introduce Dr. Don Clark, biochemist and member of the board of Creation Moments. It's creationmoments.com, by the way. You can visit them from our website if you're so inclined. It's a great place to go, great resource for your church and for your small Bible studies and your small group discussions and the like. Heike Dodge is with us, too. Heike, you're still here, aren't you?
I'm here.
Okay, I'm looking. She has a little picture up of a little chick, which is apropos, I suppose. But it kind of looks like spring, and that's a nice thing. Don, we're going to talk about desertification today, and tell us first of all what does that word mean?
Well, it's actually turning productive land into desert is basically what it means, and that's happening all over the world. I mean, it can happen in this country. Folks would think, well, we got so much technology that it's impossible to happen here. But our agricultural practices and over farming land is also causing the problem here. Obviously, it's happening in places where they're burning the forest and cutting down the forest to make cropland. It's a major problem. And if we keep going at this clip, Alan Savory, who is an ecologist who's been studying this problem all of his life, basically not all of his life, but all of his adult life, let's say, is really concerned about this issue. And he thinks he has a solution to the problem.
Now, in the video, and then we'll again link this or give you the link here on the audio archive page after our conversation this morning. But it includes one of the TED topics, one of the TED short programs. It's about 22 minutes long. It's a video, and in the video, Alan Savory shows some maps and talks about the process and claims that this is affecting about two-thirds of the landmass around the world, this desertification process. Is it really that extensive, Don?
Oh, I believe it is, yes. And it's not only continuing, but it's accelerating as we do the things that I mentioned earlier of deforestation and overcropping the land, trying to manage the land that isn't cropped in grasslands by reducing the number of animals. And we're going to talk about how that is counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is then about changing what Alan Savory terms the microclimate of the soil. And the logical consequence is the disappearance of vegetation, grass and trees and things that make it green and keep it productive. And keeps kind of the cycle of life going in that soil, in the soil. Does this have a connection with global climate change?
Well, certainly it would, because if you take the grasslands out and you replace it with bare soil, the bare soil reflects the sun's light instead of the grasslands absorbing it. And you have a shift of moisture away from that area, and hence the term desertification. So you can change a perfectly good environment, which is lush and green and has enough water, to one of being dry and arid just by doing some of the negative practices that we've been doing.
And actually rather rapidly, isn't that true? I mean, it's not generations, not centuries, but a few years or a decade or two.
Right. Easily within 3 to 4 years, you can change a very productive land into something that's not productive.
Now, Alan Savory talks about an episode in his life. He apparently was raised in Africa. Says he loved wildlife there. But in his studies and his education as an ecologist, he became convinced that the problem was overgrazing. That there were too many animals there, and he put together a project and spearheaded this project that lasted several years, by which he exterminated 40,000 elephants. And in the ensuing years, noticed that nothing got better, it actually got worse. And he now defines this as maybe the worst decision, the worst chapter in his life, and he's devoted the rest of his life to somehow making it right, finding solutions to the desertification process. And so it's kind of led him to the opposite conclusion, apparently, that now we need more grazing animals. What do you think of that idea, Don?
Well, I think it's a fantastic idea. I think that it's, initially it's counterintuitive, because you would think that, and there's agricultural practices even in this country and obviously around the world that would say you can only put so many animals on, let's say, an acre of land. Mm-hmm. And what he was doing was using those practices. So there were a bunch of elephants in the area where, obviously he convinced the government to kill all of these elephants. And as you said, the land became almost inhabitable, as far as the animals were concerned. Instead of improving it, it kind of destroyed the land. Now, let's start asking our question, why would that be? If you've got animals like elephants, they tear up trees and get the vegetation off the trees. Without animals, you're not fertilizing the ground. And in areas, when the ground's not being fertilized with obviously urine and semi-processed food byproducts, you don't have a healthy soil, and the microbes in the soil begin to die out, and then the vegetation that's on top of on top and in the surface of the soil then die. So the approach is to bring animals back into grazing areas and other areas, and then that would bring the natural fertilization back into the soil, and the land would then become productive again.
Well, what about the argument that all these animals produce methane, and that affects the ozone layer and actually brings harm to us, allows the sun's ultraviolet rays to penetrate in greater intensity. Is that old thinking, or is that still a concern to this? In other words, I mean, there's got to be a balance point somewhere where it's the right, you would be able to overdo it. And how would we know?
Well, when you stop getting the beneficial effects, and what he is proposing, for example, and I'm just giving you a rough example. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I don't necessarily have the numbers right in front of me at the moment, but he is proposing greatly multiplying the number of animals per square acre, for example, or hectare. I mean, by hundreds or thousands, fold as to what the previous thinking has been. And the benefits that he's seeing is, and he's got, you know, there's pictures on the Mercola website, and he's got pictures in his video of transformed areas that are have been pretty much barren. And within a couple of years, plant life grows back. Even if you put like 40,000, you know, sheep or goats or cattle in a certain area, and you would think there's no way. But not only do they survive, but the land is completely transformed to lush pasture land again.
Now, is he talking specifically about grazing animals? That's the kind of animal that's the subject here?
Well, I mean, it's grazing animals. It's exotic animals elephants and giraffes and in Africa, for example. Mm-hmm. It's all types of animals. He's taking the approach of a more holistic approach of let's bring the land back to where it was before man got really involved too much.
Aha, uh-huh. Back to when? When is that? What point in history? What point in history should be like? I mean, are we talking the Garden of Eden here?
Well, I think the closer you can get to the Garden of Eden, the better it would be. Mm-hmm. Now we don't have the Garden of Eden anymore, but we can approach that. I mean, I can just add, not necessarily inside the Garden of Eden, but the wilderness outside the Garden of Eden was chock full of animals.
Mm-hmm.
And we have selectively over the thousands of years killed them off and reduced the numbers of animals to a very low number. They were.
Just one second, Don Heike. We're getting a lot of echo from Don from your channel there for some reason. Don's very strong in the background.
Okay, what can they do about that?
Well, I'm not sure. We're still trying to figure out the technology here.
Should I go away?
Well, no, I don't want you to, go away. Actually,
maybe I should go away. No, I'm sorry.
No, don't do that. It seems to be fixed now for the moment.
Okay,
well, let's just go ahead. So I'm thinking that this balance in the animals, I mean, there are grazing animals, and in areas of the world where those grazing animals were predominant, there are also predators. Wouldn't we need predators then to keep them in line? And now we're talking lions and tigers here.
Well, he's doing that in Africa. I mean, because as you get the grazing animals, for example, the lions and the tigers, they actually go after the weak in the herd that's on the outside of the herd. So a herd stays together to protect themselves, but those that are weak can't get into the center of the herd. And so there's a natural thinning of the herd and balance of the herd that takes place by these predatory animals.
Hmm. And so I'm thinking in a country like the U.S. where we don't want lions and tigers, but, you know, occasional wolves and mountain lions are okay. If these are grazing animals, this might well be food stock. You know, beef cattle.
It could be beef, beef cattle. It could be goats. It could be sheep. I mean, we can learn. I mean, most of the 90% of the world eats goats, and we don't. It's hard to find any goats and sheep in the grocery store.
That's true.
I mean, my wife was looking for some lamb to serve during Easter Sunday. And she couldn't find it in the grocery store at all. I mean, she went to several different grocery stores, and they just don't have it around here.
Well, it's hard to find up here, too. It really is.
I think around here you would have to go to a someone who just, you know, raised them for themselves, or, you know, go directly to the farmer. So as you're talking about these large herds, I keep envisioning tens of thousands of chicken herds.
Well, of course, Nike's in the chicken.
Yeah, free range chickens, not the ones in the cages.
No, yeah, and you know, when you free range chickens, the meat tastes better and the eggs taste better, and I'm just envisioning world hunger could be solved if we could just get, you know, 100,000 chickens to graze in Africa.
Yeah, and think about the insect population. They take a beating from all these chickens, too. Absolutely. That's something we appreciate around here. Wood ticks a real threat to life and limb in large areas of the country now with the diseases they carry. There seem to be a number of benefits to the idea of having more wild animals around. Well, I say wild, but, you know, free animals around. I think back to, and I just, it wasn't long ago, I read the James Michener novel. I reread it, really. I love the book, Centennial. And it's about the development of ranching in the middle part of the country, in Nebraska and Colorado and Kansas and up into Montana. And so much of that industry was based upon the notion of a cow-calf combination, that is the limit of animal number of animals that could an area of land could support. And it was like one cow-calf unit per acre or whatever it happened to be, because the grass was so rare out there. Don't deserts occur naturally anyway, Don? I mean, at that point in this country, and there had been herds of buffalo that roamed from Virginia and Kentucky clear across to the Rocky Mountains and north. I mean, bazillions of buffaloes in herds that people have witnessed that you couldn't see the sky. I mean, it went all clear to the horizon. And, of course, they disappeared. And after that came the cattle industry, and found that the grazing was pretty hard to come by. Grazing lands were rare and very valuable. What can we learn from that? That maybe the area prospered with all the not buffalo, technically it's bison. American bison lived there, and the land prospered. After they disappeared, it went bad, and we have it largely semi-arid like we see it today.
Well, in that, there's a couple of things going on. One, we don't have enough animals on the land, I think, if we go along with Savory's recommendation. And two, the bison were migrating animals. And you know, cows are migrating animals by nature as well. We just keep them in a location by having them penned up. So it's the herding of these animals, and so after an area has been, let's say, grazed down by the animals, and if they're allowed to move to a new area, that allows time for the fertilizer that they just laid down to penetrate into the soil and the grasses to grow back again. So you don't keep the animals on that particular land, in a high number, for sure, for a long period of time, because it's kind of like crop rotation, but in this case, it's animal rotation where the animals actually move off the land, go somewhere else, eat the fresh grass, and then by the time that has been eaten down, they can come back to the area that they had previously left. Now, the interesting thing, another outcome of all of this is what our government is encouraging. And it's encouraging in the opposite direction of what we need to be doing in order to avert desertification. And it has to be, and primarily has to be, involves corn and soy. And the methanol policy of our government, it has, and the insurance policy has pretty much guaranteed farmers that they're going to make money if they raise corn and soybeans for fossil fuel purposes, for ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
And they, farmers, are now moving into, or have been moving into, areas which were traditionally grasslands and not very good for farming. And they're farming those areas. And if they produce a crop that year, well, great. The corn and soy prices have been increasing over time. And so, you know, they're going to get a good return on their efforts. But if something happens and they don't get enough rain or whatever, that doesn't matter either, because they'll get their return back, not as much as they would have had they sold the product, but through the insurance, they get reimbursed. So
this sounds like such an artificial contrivance that, and I've got to tell you, I was at a seminar, Bible Alive seminar, the last couple of days, in which the term God's economy came up frequently. And it's my understanding that it takes more energy to produce ethanol than the ethanol itself produces. In other words, it's like pouring money into something and getting less back than you're spending on it, in economic terms. So, what you're telling me is that the government is producing a self-destructive process that won't work in the end.
No, it's not. It's not economical. It doesn't make sense. We're causing those lands where they're doing this. We're causing them to go ultimately to go into desertification, because the land is not going to sustain the degree of farming that they're doing. And eventually they'll have to move off the land. And when they do, it will be a desert.
You know, this sounds like such an overwhelming task to me to revert somehow, to reverse the way that at least the Western world has been living. How do you conceive that this could ever be implemented? I suspect maybe Alan Savory has some ideas in this video. I'll have to watch the whole thing, but I can't see the government doing it well. The only alternative would be for private enterprise, families, small businesses, to change the way they gather and raise food, wouldn't you say?
Well, for sure, and the government has a role. I mean, the government had a negative role, so government can have a positive role and say, look, if you don't farm that land and you put cattle, you know, or whatever, back on that land, we will, at least initially, like they're doing with the corn and the soy, give you a stipend, or some money to help you get over the lean years that are going to be initially feel. So the government can have a positive role if they see this in to benefit, you know, to benefit man. But oftentimes, governments don't necessarily see it in that light, and they see it, well, what is it that we want to get out of it? Mm-hmm. And so it's up to, you know, people, and people like Alan and you know, all of us, to encourage this type of practice. And, you know, the more natural we can go, as we talked about before on this program, mm-hmm. the better off all of us are.
You know, back in the 19th century, there were homestead laws, and I presume they're still on the books, although I'm not sure how they function in this day and age. But it was then that you were invited, and farmers moved out from the grain belt states and into the western states, and simply occupied land for 3 years, improved it, farmed it, and then they were given the land. And I think we have to see that as a successful program. Rather than the government funneling money or assuring income, they simply gave land in return. I wonder if that's still possible. What do you think? Another homestead program.
Yeah, the government owns a whole, has a whole bunch of land, and that's for, we can talk probably a whole another program about that, but mm-hmm. If the government had a program like that to allow farming again, the problem is we try to interfere with the natural system. I mean, you know, these farmers that are farming this marginal land to begin with, they wouldn't be doing it unless there was a program to secure their success.
Secure their income. But if we look away from income and look at feeding your family on a small area of land in Hyke, this is where you come in, because you've told us that you got 12 acres, which is not a whole lot of land. You've talked on occasion of even in a suburban yard, you know, a little half acre or three quarters of an acre, that you can do much to feed your family from that. I mean, convert the grass lawn, that nice grass lawn that comes to us from England and it's showy, and start planting stuff there and maybe letting a few chickens run.
Absolutely. I mean, I have 12 acres and almost all of it is just left for hay for the neighbor. If I wanted to be completely self-sufficient, I think I could definitely do it on 12 acres. I could get some cows and I could rotate, or cows or sheep or goats, whatever my, you know, meat preference beyond my chickens is, and I could rotate them in patches around my 12 acres. And, you know, as the article discussed that we're, you know, basing our conversation on here, you put them in a quarter and you let them graze that down, and then you move them. And as they're grazing the next quarter, that next one is being fertilized by the stuff the animals left behind. Mm-hmm. And they've eaten down that grass, and that's turned into mulch. And they've kicked up the dirt, too, as they're walking around. Their hooves have kicked up the dirt, and so it's kind of plowed it under a little bit. And you just keep rotating it without overgrazing, as that old theory was thought to be the problem. And you end up having more fertile land. I mean, right now, I have the septic guy come out and put, you know, the remains out on my pasture just to fertilize it, because I don't have a natural way to do that. I don't have cows, sheep, or goats to naturally fertilize my hay field, so I have septic remains come out and fertilize. So I absolutely think that it, you can have a huge impact in a small amount of area between gardening and rotating your animals. Absolutely.
You know, I'm thinking to the little town of Norco, which stands for North Corona. It's east of Los Angeles, and it's where my parents moved after I had left the nest and my brothers and sisters were gone, and they kind of settled there. And Norco was very proud of the fact that it had more horses than people. And the neighborhoods were broken up and fenced off with little chain-link fences, each, you know, maybe three-quarters of an acre lots. And everybody seemed to have a horse or two or three or four. And some people pushed the limits a little bit and had small stables out there. And what they never bragged about on the Chamber of Commerce billboards was all the flies that were attracted as well. Mm-hmm. There were consequences to having so many animals around. And flies and insects and other critters can bring disease and cause other problems. Where do you think the balance is, Heike? If you can see us as a nation of small farms again, and I'm very small. How about an acre, maybe? A family of four. Could a family of four support themselves on an acre and not be a nuisance to everybody else around them?
I think if we made some dietary changes, we are a very carnivorous society where we need to have a big slab of meat and vegetables are an afterthought. And I think if we reversed that, the health department recently did away with the food pyramid, and they redid it into a plate. 50% of the plate is fruits and vegetables, a quarter of the plate is grains, and a quarter of the plate is meat. And if we spent more time focusing on our diet in that type of a model, I think we'd be fine. And we can grow a lot of fruits and vegetables on a small amount of land. My family doesn't keep 52 chickens for itself for a year because we don't eat a chicken every week. But I could, if I wanted to eat only chicken and didn't want to integrate beef, pork, or other meats into my diet, I could raise 52 chickens on 1 acre or a half acre lot, stick them in the freezer, and that's my meat for the year. And I wouldn't ever have to go to the grocery store and buy meat. So, you know, and if I wanted to have, you know, an acre in town and have a few chickens, maybe 20 chickens in a year, and I wanted to have a goat or a sheep or maybe split a cow with a neighbor, it doesn't take a lot of room. And if we're not eating meat three times a day and we're not eating the large amount that we seem to want to do here in America, it is very, very doable. And we'd be healthier, we'd be thinner, and actually going out and doing all those chores, we'd get a lot more exercise. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be spending so much time on the couch. There are a lot of benefits to having a few animals in your backyard.
I see a whole family of symbiotic or side economies here, too, and you've seen some of that, where a friend of yours can process chickens in return for some of the chickens, and you get back processed chickens that are usable for you. You don't have to do all the slaughtering and cleaning and sanitary concerns. This is true in much of the world, isn't it, Don? That people really, I'm thinking of that government plate now that's half full of vegetables and fruits and just a quarter of it is meat. That's the case in much of the world, isn't it? There's no choice there. Don, do we still have
in most parts of the country. Hello?
Yep. I think we got you.
Okay. Okay. Yes. If you...
Don, I think
mission work anywhere outside the country.
Yeah, I think the connection is degenerated here quite a bit, Don, in the silence. So there's apparently a knack to keeping a four-way Skype conversation going.
When they have me.
Yeah, I'm afraid.
I'm going to jump in here.
Yeah, please do that.
Just mention to you guys.
Yeah, you folks are breaking up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
My sister just got back from another 3 months in Ecuador. She's been studying Spanish for the last two winters in Ecuador. And one of the pieces of information that she's brought back to me is that in Ecuador, they eat less meat, but they also eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, a lot more fruits and vegetables. And they're locally grown. You don't get something that's shipped in from another country, with the exception of a few items. Most everything they eat in that country is you know, just grown down the road or just down the hillside, and the chickens are just out in the country, not too far away. There's, you know, the road system in Ecuador is not great, so the ability to ship a lot of things in and out isn't there. The infrastructure isn't there, so they're forced to eat more locally, and they're a very healthy population, and they walk everywhere. So, you know, there is a mass transit system, but it's not what we think of in America, and the road systems aren't what we are used to in America. And mm-hmm. I think globally that's, you know, certainly in Central and South America, that's much more the case. And, you know, up here in Minnesota, where it's a cold climate, we're used to eating our apples in the fall and winter storing them and learning how to stretch those vegetables and fruits mm-hmm. Further into the winter and eating what is in season. That's something that's kind of become a lost art. Eating what is in season and not expecting a fresh, ripe whatever in the midst of December or January, and eating what's winter stored. So
Well, we're talking about potentially huge changes in the way we live and think and interact, and maybe reversing centuries of regression. I mean, going in the wrong direction. And I think of the importing not only foods, but people and ships and packing materials and animals and moving them across the world has really changed the way the world was in the last 500 or 600 years, and made us much more alike, and has killed an awful lot of people by importing diseases and things that we do. There's a whole layer of life and energy that we don't see and don't understand, and those changes occur whenever we start moving goods and people around from place to place on the face of the earth. I mean, huge monumental changes, wiping out 90% of the Native American population by diseases that came across inadvertently, starting with Columbus. I mean, this is a huge, huge topic, and it's got to really at some point be just seen as the province of God to make these changes. But maybe we can start on a micro level. And Heike, I really like your ideas of starting family by family, family unit by family unit, and learning some of these skills and maybe reinstituting some things that we've forgotten and actually had practiced over the past 200 years. Don, are you back?
I am back.
Okay. Now all of a sudden the sound is good again. We lost you there for a while, but I'm just commenting about what a fundamental change in expectations and energy use and lifestyle this is. Could we hope to see this change happen in our lifetimes? This seems like it has to be taken on incrementally and done over a number of generations.
Well, yeah, that's certainly one way of doing it. Or the other way is that if there's, you know, if our economy ever collapses, and I believe that is on the horizon with our practices that we currently have, mm-hmm. It could be forced on us.
Mm-hmm. So no choice. may just be the choice, huh?
No. Okay. Yeah, I think that's probably, you know, I'm not as optimistic as some of you folks. I think that we don't change, and I used to think it was just Americans, but I think it's everybody else in the world. We don't change until the disaster is right in front of our faces, and then it's a choice between continuing to live like we were or continuing to live, period. And we'll take choice number two, and then we'll continue on. But I think until then, you know, we pay our doctors and lawyers a lot of money, and we don't pay our teachers relatively anything in comparison. I'm not talking about public education now. I'm talking about people that actually teach us about things like desertification, and the damage that we've done. I think the lesson for the future is more like Stockton, California, where people are suddenly realizing, oh, we can't do this anymore. Detroit's looking at the same thing. I mean, the economic managers in Detroit are saying, listen, there's two ways we can do this. We can reduce the expenditures in Detroit. The easy way, if you guys get together and say, okay, we're all going to take a little less or a lot less, or the hard way, we'll go to bankruptcy, and then you'll get nothing. Yeah, I'm I don't know. I'd love to be optimistic and say everybody will sit down and have a kumbaya moment, and everybody will get together and we'll say, you know, let's all get ducks and chickens and goats in our backyard. But Monsanto won't like that.
Yeah.
And that's where the tax structure is right now. Mm-hmm. And until it collapses, it's going to continue.
Well, and of course, biblically speaking, maybe it collapses. You know, it's what happened before and may well be in our future again. But on an individual basis, I think we can each of us make decisions to do it the right way. And if not, improve life globally, at least in our families, in our communities, and maybe bring things together, teach some of the old skills and get back to the earth. I think of, you know, I just moved recently to a small place on a hill surrounded by 80 acres, and it's close to town. And I decided, I think I mentioned this before, decided rather than drive into town, I'm going to walk. And I saw more people and chatted with people I hadn't seen in months or even years. Had a great time. That wouldn't have happened had I driven.
Mm-hmm. And your neighbors are getting chickens next year.
Yes. And I'm pretty excited about that, too.
I'm going
to learn all about chickens. We've been talking with Dr. Don Clark, a biochemist, and again, a member of the board of creationmoments.com. I'd like to encourage you to visit their website. You can link to it from ours at brokenroadradio.com. And on our website, under audio archives, there's a whole almost 2 years worth of conversations with Don now that we do every week on Monday mornings, and talk about matters largely centering on creation and faith and science and evolution and that kind of thing. And today talking about desertification. You might be interested in even despite the technical glitches here today, listening to this and maybe going over to that Mercola page and reading the video. Don, thanks very much. We'll look forward to a conversation with you next Monday, okay?
Okay, sounds great.
And apologize for the bad sound this morning here. Heike, thank you for your contributions, too. That was great.
Absolutely.
Music from New Song on a Broken Road Radio Monday morning.